Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello and welcome to Project Zion, the Restoration Caffeinated. Today is the third podcast in a new international series, Grounds for Peace, under the auspices of peaceprojects.eu. In this series, we are asking what are the grounds, you might say the foundations, for a new peaceful humanity. I am your host, Elray Henriksen, team leader of the Community of Christ European Peace and Justice Team and full-time volunteer for Community of Christ in Europe. According to Steve Easy, president of Community of Christ, no matter where we start from as individuals, our calling, our purpose as a human species is to be a peaceful humanity. The phrase peaceful humanity is another way of saying Zion, God's peaceful reign on earth where everything is as it should be. Today, our guest is Zach Harmon McLaughlin in a further discussion on ecumenical and interfaith partnerships and advocacy. Reverend Dr. Zach Harmon McLaughlin is the Dean and faculty member of the Community of Christ Seminary and Director of Religious Studies at Graceland University. Zach received a BA in Religion in 2008 from Graceland and an MA in Religion in 2010 from the Community of Christ Seminary. He recently completed his Doctorate of Ministry in Executive Leadership from San Francisco Theological Seminary. His dissertation was titled Post-Church Ecclesiology, the Future of Community of Christ Through Ambiguity and Principle. Zach is an ordained minister of Community of Christ and holds the priesthood of 70. He currently serves the church as a member of the interfaith and ecumenical team. He is passionate about peace and justice, environmental justice and belonging. And Zach considers himself a practitioner scholar. His favorite quote is from theologian Anne Lamott. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty. Please say hello to our listeners, Zach.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you, Zach. What are the things in relation to church that you are most certain about?
What are the things that I'm uncertain about?
No, most certain about.
Most certain about? Here's what I always tell people. So I have 3 degrees in religion. And the only thing that I'm really certain about is that I am not God. So that's my certainty level. And what I mean by that is I am a part of God. I am beloved by God. I am with God. I co-create with God. I am not God. So that's the end of my certainty.
Well, thank you. I mean, back in the days, I used to talk about divine masculinity. So perhaps that's one of those things we ought to explore. Zach, I'm so glad you could join us today to continue this important discussion about one of the dimensions of our holistic peacemaking model that informs this peace colloquy. One of those I find the most interesting and crucial, perhaps, which is to form action teams for peace. So, Zach, you recently gave a webinar on ecumenical and interfaith partnerships and advocacy as part of the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. Our listeners can access this webinar at peaceprojects.eu or on the Community of Christ Europe YouTube page. First, is it possible for you to explain to our listeners what ecumenism is and also what we mean perhaps by interfaith partnerships?
Yeah. So when we talk about ecumenical work or ecumenicism, what we're really talking about is cross-Christian partnerships. So multiple denominations or faith identities within the Christian paradigm. And so ecumenicism is when, for example, Catholics and Community of Christ come together to work on a common project that shares some missional alignment for both entities. So it's not the work of proselytizing or trying to convince others to join your denominational identity. It's the work of partnering to further the kingdom of God, God's preferred future. So ecumenicism is cross-Christian partnering. And then when we talk about interfaith, that's when we expand a little bit farther out. And so interfaith partnerships are where we go beyond the Christian paradigm, beyond the Christian story and Christian theology into other avenues of faith. So Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, all these these various forms of faith to, again, find those points of commonality, those points of missional alignment. While we may have different theological perspectives and we may have different praxis or practice, we also share a desire to fulfill and engage for the common good. So ecumenicism is kind of Christian-focused. Interfaith work is beyond the Christian scope as we kind of further the betterment of the world through our shared missionally aligned praxis.
Great. So the African-American theologian Howard Thurman, to this, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who've come alive. So for me, you're one of those people, I think, who have come alive. And one of my first questions was immediately, so tell me, why are you so excited?
Well, that is about an hour-long answer, and I know this podcast isn't that long. I believe in transformation, and I've had this just amazingly blessed life. And one of the blessings of my life was to be able to be a World Service Corps volunteer with Community of Christ. When I was 20 when I started, and my birthday was actually while I was on my assignment, and so I turned 21. But I was sent to Zambia, Africa, and I spent most of my time in rural Zambia, in the northern part of the country, and it changed my life forever. It was the first place I met Jesus, even though I had been baptized since I was 8 years old, gone to church every week since I was a child, heard Jesus preach from the pulpit for more than a decade, and then the first time I met Jesus, I was 21 in rural Zambia. What I mean by that is I began to read. So there was so much space. The pace of life in Zambia, at least at that point of time when I was there, was so much slower than my Western U.S. pace of life, which was just do, 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 go, 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 go. I had all this space in my day-to-day life. And so I didn't have anything with me but a Bible. I started reading the New Testament. And the more I read the New Testament, the more I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know who this Jesus is, because this Jesus that I'm reading about is a radical criminal who's a revolutionary. He's innovative. He's engaging in challenging the status quo and confronting systems and practices that are broken. And I was like, where's this Jesus been my whole life? And keep in mind, I'm reading about this Jesus while I am in the midst of the world's poorest of the poor. And so the backdrop for me reading this New Testament is in a village where there's no electricity, no running water. We had to walk about almost just shy of a mile to the community pump. And so I'm reading about this radical Jesus coming from this Western paradigm in the US where we have an overabundance of whatever we want and consumerism out the wazoo. And I'm reading about this radical Jesus who is saying, set all that down. Notice the oppressed and marginalized. The good news is for the poor. And I'll never forget a long, like I said, this is like an hour long testimony, but a long story short, when I was in my 20s, my early 20s, I really wanted to travel the world. I wanted to work in the global South. I wanted to be in those places doing advocacy work and working on poverty and issues of humanitarian issues. And one day in Zambia, I was feeling really kind of just overwhelmed by the complexity of the world, this Jesus that was messing up my life. And I went out and I took a short walk from the small house we were staying in. And I sat on this giant termite hill that had one singular tree kind of growing out of it. And I just started to breathe, and this leaf fell from the tree onto my leg. And I remember looking at this leaf and just thinking, this insignificant, meaningless leaf that no one cares about is perfect. It was created with such care and such thoughtfulness. The everything was perfect on it. And the next thing that just entered my heart, my soul, was this sense of, Zach, heal the church. Now, I say that not as like I'm some savior or anything like that. So please, listeners, don't misunderstand me. I do not think I'm the fixer of the church by any means. But this just deep impression, heal the church. And what I took from that experience was, if we can stop playing church and become the church, we can change the world. If we can move beyond our complacency and the church paradigm, at least where I come from in the United States, of church is about me and my needs and what I am, and shift our focus to the prophetic reality of the inward-outward journey, the interior life that's coupled and paired at its root with the external life. All of that pushed me to this place now where, you know, I feel like my sense of call is really, I want to be the church. I want to embody it. I want to incarnate it. I want to be the hands and feet of Jesus in a broken world.
So what I'm hearing is two things, actually. One is the major contrast between your life as it was coming from the US and meeting rural Africa.
Yeah.
Rural Zambia. And the other is kind of a moment of deep introspection of what's the purpose of all of this? Why are we doing this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I left that experience in Zambia and I came right back to Kansas City, Missouri in the United States, where I grew up. On my way back to Graceland University, where I was in college at the time. And I told everyone who would listen about Jesus, about this radical person, that the more I read the New Testament, the more I learned about this Jesus, the more I realized, oh my gosh, in my mind, salvation was all about me. In my mind, being baptized, salvation was for my soul, was for my identity. The more I read the words of Jesus, the more I walked away from that conversation with Jesus of, oh my gosh, salvation is about belovedness and belonging. And belonging and belovedness only happen when I see myself and when I see Jesus in you, when the other is no longer the other. And that's a transformational thought, because all of a sudden you can't just simply say, well, it's not an issue for me. That's somebody else's problem. Because you say, wait a minute, that's my salvation. That is my belovedness. And so I can't just cast the marginalized off, or the oppressed off, or the poor off, or, you know, whatever. I have to deeply and authentically engage with that. And that's not to say, you know, I fail at that all the time, right? I'm not perfect. I participate in a capitalist culture that is based on consumerism that often, you know, dismisses, sometimes with intention, sometimes with unintention, the poor. Anyway, all of that to say, my deep sense of call rests in this reality that in their welfare resides my welfare. It's the truest sense of compassion to suffer with the other.
So as one of your students, I've heard you talk about God's preferred future a lot. Could you say a bit more about what you mean by that phrase, and how you came to use that phrase, actually, because it was new to me when I heard you say it.
Yeah. So I actually get asked this a lot. I did not coin the phrase. I've heard it used in various settings, particularly in the ecumenical and interfaith world. I started using it partly because I find the phrase kingdom of God a bit tricky. Kingdom, the way in which Jesus is using it, Jesus is using the word kingdom as a direct challenge to authority and power. So he's trying to shape, you know, this different vision of what a kingdom looks like. They're living in the midst of empirical rule. But kingdom still implies a hierarchy. It still implies this idea, you know, that there's a top and a bottom. And so then eventually I shifted to the phraseology of kingdom of God, this idea of belonging and belovedness, like I just talked about. But most recently, in the last couple of years, I've been using the phrase God's preferred future. So as a prophetic body, you know, community of Christ, we believe that we're in continual relationship, revelatory relationship with God. And if that's the case, then that makes the assumption that God is still creating, that God is actively engaging the world in transformation and change. And so that would get us theologically to a place where we can begin to articulate God has a preference. God is working towards something meaningful, something different that surely this creation that we're a part of has work to do, has room to grow. And so this idea of working with God toward God's preferred future indicates a reality that it's not done. It's not perfect. There's work to be done. And so anyway, one of my favorite kind of uses of that phrase has been, was at the USA National Council of Churches gathering last year. We gathered on the beach in Virginia where in 1619, so we gathered in 2019, in 1619, the first enslaved Africans arrived on the beaches of North America, at least documented. And we gathered to pray, to lament, to confess, you know, this tragic sin of slavery and racism. And the speaker of the day simply shared the phrase, "Let us work toward God's preferred future in which racism doesn't have one." And that grabbed me to the core, this idea that in God's preferred future, in God's preference, certain things don't exist. Racism doesn't exist. Violence doesn't exist, which, you know, we in the Community of Christ Church see with a lion and a lamb, predator and prey, you know, mortal enemies where violence must take place for the sustaining of life. Yet in God's preferred future, that violence doesn't exist. Life finds a different way. So that's kind of where that comes from. It's simply a way to articulate our partnership and prophetic relationship with God.
So I love that this has ecumenical roots. I mean, this is great in terms of this podcast, this question that we're kind of exploring. In that sense, it makes the next question, which is really, how do we partner with God in making that future happen? Because this is really what this is about. How do we go down to actually doing it?
Yeah. So this is like really key, particularly when we talk about creating action teams. You know, many of us that live in Western countries have been educated through a lens of critical thinking. And so we're solution oriented by virtue of our education. We see a problem and we want to fix it. The problem with that when we start talking about giant social or humanitarian issues is that the solutions are overwhelming, right? And we often will find ourselves in conversation with one another where we say, what can I do to change climate change, right? Like, I'm not an executive of a oil and gas company. What am I going to do, right? Like, there's only so much me in the Midwest of the United States. Sure, I can recycle. I can lower my single-use plastic consumption. There's things I can do, but it's overwhelming to think about the big picture solution. When we start thinking about issues of peace and justice, we often hold ourselves hostage to the 50,000 foot solution of humanitarian problems. What's so important here is that we really grab onto the wisdom of Mother Teresa. And this is something that is often overlooked, but so deeply, wildly, profoundly important. You know, Mother Teresa was flooded with visitors who would seek her out in Calcutta, simply to just try to almost, it reminds me of like the scripture where the woman tries to touch the hem of Jesus's robe, right? Just to get a touch, just to maybe some of that profound ministry will rub off on me if I can just get close. So people flooded Mother Teresa, right? And she would always tell these people, often Westerners who would come, just do small things with great love. Small things with great love will change the world. And I think when we begin to talk about how we actually partner with God, we have to let go of our aspirational hope. And so don't misunderstand me, listeners. I'm not talking about, well, let's set down aspiration and hope. What I'm talking about is calibrating that to our context. So if I am just one person in the Midwest of the United States of America, what can I begin to do to create change? Realizing that my subtle actions have much broader ripples and engagement with complex systems than I know. And so as we begin to form action teams, we need to focus on our context, on our community, and begin to notice through some of the process in which I laid out in the webinar, which you can go and watch, but really beginning to work through small actions that are transformative for community. And ultimately, what those small actions do is they create story. And ultimately, out of that story, we begin to tell that story, and other people are empowered and inspired. And this is ultimately what changes legislation and policy on national levels and then global levels that have a transforming effect, right? And you see this with, you know, communities in the Appalachians of the United States have worked for decades to end mountaintop removal for mining. And they begin to tell stories of how this has impacted their family. And that story is way more engaging than the data we know, the empirical data that mountaintop removal has terrible environmental effects. But people tend to cast aside the data. It's data. So it's like, well, yeah, that's bad, but it doesn't really impact me. That's a shame for that mountain, but I don't really live near that mountain, so it's not a problem. But when you hear the story of a child who's gotten sick because of chemical runoff has gotten into the water of their family's home, that's very different. That's a different story than the data that's associated with it. So all this is to say, small actions in our communities where we live, in our context, to set in motion meaningful change. There's a wonderful book by Susan Beaumont called How to Lead When You Don't Know Where You're Going. And in this book, she talks about the difference between aspirational purpose and proximate purpose. And what she's really trying to articulate is, so if we really want to change systemic racism, and the aspiration is to end systemic racism, we have to start with baby steps. And she uses the metaphor of building the bridge as we're walking on it. Mm-hmm. So not waiting for the bridge to be done so we can walk across it. That's gonna take too much time, and we'll end up quitting because that's just way too much work. But if we walk on the bridge while we're building it, board by board, piece by piece, slow, small, subtle actions of meaningful change, ultimately we're getting closer and closer to the aspirational purpose. So we all need to heed the wisdom of Mother Teresa: small actions with great love.
Love that. You mentioned in that webinar also Matthew 18, where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there also. Say more about how small action teams actually make a difference? Because it's not, for me, it's not just the one person doing small acts of great love. It's kind of when two or three actually come together and share a vision, share a mission, decide to do something together. Actually, that's when things happen.
That's right. So I was actually going to start going down that road, but I felt like I was getting too preachy. that's exactly right. So Matthew 18 has really become kind of a northern star for me, a guiding light. Again, many of us who live in Western cultures, by virtue of how our cultures are created through capitalism, we have business models of success in our minds, right? Even for the church. And so bigger is better. More numbers are better, right? And this is how we think. We think about it in terms of money. We think about it in terms of people. And so that's just how we think and process. And so the assumption in the United States where I live is, well, your church is dying if you have less than 20 people attending every week. It's dying. And that's bad. And I'm over here thinking, why do we think that? Who said it's dying? And at what point did we decide there was like a critical number, a critical mass to make sure church was church? Because Jesus is over here saying, hey, two or three, because the gospel is relational. So you've got to have at least two, but you don't need more than that. Because here's the thing, church folk, God can do impossible things. God can raise a dead man. God can resurrect. God can transform empire. God can topple mountains. And we're over here saying, no, that's just a story. That's just some crazy story. And God is saying, no, I make the impossible possible. I make transformation reality. I make incarnation every day. And so, and I even often will joke, because Community of Christ says, to form a congregation, you need at least six. And so I always joke and say, Community of Christ thinks we're a little better than Jesus, because you know, Jesus says two or three and Community of Christ is like, no, 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 let's double that. Let's go with six just to be on the safe side. So, you know, that's just a little joke there. No one get mad at me. But this is where we're really talking about reorienting success.
Yeah.
And Margaret Mead, you know, many of us have heard that quote from Margaret Mead. Never forget that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And this is true, right? You think of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, these people who changed the world. It began with small actions, with just a couple of folk, where they decided to stand up and show up and say, this is not okay. Someone must do something about this. And ultimately, what gravitated people to those movements, more than data, more than fact, more than truth, was the stories they told. And those stories transformed the world.
So you have one story that I'd like to hear recently because of Black Lives Matter movement. Yeah. You took initiative for something. What did that mean? What did that imply? Yeah. Could you share a bit of that story with us?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so for the listeners, obviously the United States was rocked months ago by the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, because it's the United States, everything becomes political and everything becomes right or left. And that makes ethical and moral issues incredibly frustrating because for me, these aren't political issues. These are issues of humanity that as a disciple of Jesus, I don't look at murder through a political lens. I look at it through the compassionate, beloved nature of God's beloved. For me, that's a hard thing to connect with. So anyway, I live in Independence, Missouri, and I live about a block from the Community of Christ Temple, which is just this beautiful place that's designated, that's blessed as an ensign of peace. It's the by far the tallest building in Independence, maybe the tallest building in Jackson County. I don't really know, but it's just this beautiful towering temple that calls our attention to peace, that calls our attention to this idea of the kingdom of God, God's preferred future. And so, as the weeks after George Floyd's murder were unfolding, you know, the United States was embroiled with protest. Every major city across the United States, New York, LA, Seattle, Kansas City, Chicago, they all had, you know, thousands and thousands of protesters saying, this is not okay. Police need to be held accountable. What happened to George Floyd was unmistakably murder. I mean, he knelt on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. I mean, just, it's impossible to try to justify that, even though people have. And so I was here in Independence, and I've been a longtime protester, and I kept thinking, wait a minute, the Community of Christ and the Restoration Movement have this long theological narrative of Zion being in Independence, Missouri. Now, for the Community of Christ, that changed. In the early 20th century, we quickly realized that Zion is not necessarily a physical isolated place, but happens across the world, that Zion exists as a condition of God's people. So we've kind of shifted that narrative, but yet still Independence, Missouri has been this kind of sacred idea of what may be possible. And I kept thinking, wait a minute. If we have this ensign of peace here, and we say that this place should be a glimpse of Zion, then where are all the people showing up to say what's happened is not okay? This is not peaceful. And that our country is broken and that we need to reorient toward peace. And so I thought, you know, it was a Thursday afternoon and I thought, I'm gonna show up. I'm gonna just, you know, put out a call to all my friends and anyone who wants to come and say, we need to stand up and proclaim this land, this spot as peaceful. And what's really crazy, El Rey, and most people don't know this, in 1945, I think it was 45, the President of the United States, Harry S. Truman, stood in the Community of Christ Auditorium and for the first time in history told people that the United States would be an original signatory to the United Nations. That happened here in Independence, Missouri. And so there's a UN Peace Plaza commemorating that event, saying this was a place where we decided we did not want war anymore following World War II, that we had failed humanity, and that never again should the sins of that war happen in this world. And so Harry Truman, as president of the United States, says, you know, we're signing on to the UN. And I'm thinking, all this is an independence. Where is the outrage? And so I simply put a call out. And this is what's really important. I'm a white heterosexual guy. Every bit of privilege, for the most part, slants my direction. And I kept thinking, I kept having this overwhelming sense of, how can I, as a white person, hold a Black Lives Matter protest? What does that mean? I don't want to speak for anybody. It's not my job to speak for anybody. And I need to be really cautious about my role in standing up for justice, which gets really complicated really quickly. And so, and actually what was really amazing is I had people in the community call me out on it. And they would call and say, hey, Zach, I saw that you're gonna march in independence. Are you going to have any Black activists speaking, or is it just you? And I said, well, I don't know. I, you know, right now it's just me and I don't know what we should do. And what was amazing was it quickly moved beyond me. And so friends would call and say, hey, I have this friend who is an advocate of Black Lives Matter. He could come and speak. And this friend, she could come and speak. And so what happened in just really like 24 hours, we had these amazing activists come and share with us from the Black perspective. And so I really did nothing. I simply stood up and welcomed everybody, said, here's why we're here. Now my job is to listen. My job is to listen and elevate these voices, to stand as an ally, as a friend, as a support. And then they took it over. And I really didn't say anything else. The only other thing I did at that protest was share a prayer. But I stepped aside to let these other voices be heard. Again, that's not about me. That's about the community holding me accountable to my privilege and saying, Zach, this isn't about you. And me knowing that and saying, yeah, but I need help. So what does this look like and how do we make this better? And I know we failed in some ways, but I also know that on a hot, hot, hot Sunday in Independence, Missouri, almost 300 people showed up to walk with me. And we knelt for 8 minutes and 46 seconds on concrete in remembrance of George Floyd, but not just George Floyd, every other Black person who has been systemically murdered in this country. Long story short, I mean, it was a powerful act of calling our attention to injustice and peace. And at the end of the day, and this gets back to your last question about action teams in particular and partnership with God. One phrase that has emerged from the Black Lives Matter movement here in the United States that I absolutely love is progression, not perfection. And what I love about that phrase is that it moves us away from the idea that unless we're going to perfectly act, we can't move, to this reality that we will fail. We're going to say the wrong thing and we're going to mess up and we're going to unintentionally maybe offend or even instantly participate in a system that's broken. But we're building that bridge as we're walking on it. We're trying to grow our awareness and understanding of the brokenness of the world so that we can be part of the healing and transformation of the world.
So one of the questions we actually got from one of our webinar attendees was, you know, it's about inquiry, willingness to not know, not having all the answers. You mentioned some of those things in the webinar. And this is similar to the spiritual practice of standing in the question or sitting with the questions. It's basically discernment.
Yeah.
The problem is that discernment can be a long process. So is there a way to practice discernment on an ongoing basis to Absolutely. Help us be ready to respond and act more swiftly or quickly? Or, you know, I mean, like you said, it's like you were saying, wait a minute, you know, and I was like, and I'm just asking, you know, how do you get to the, wait a minute, I need to do something
here. Yeah. So I often will, you know, sometimes people get frustrated with discernment because they're ready to act. They're like, we don't have time to discern. And what I always tell them in response to that is, you're doing it wrong. You know, if you're not in action, then you're not in discernment, because the two are paired. They are not mutually exclusive. They happen simultaneously together. And so this is really important. In fact, Parker Palmer, the author, activist, sociologist, theologian, if you're not familiar with Parker Palmer, read him. He's great. He calls it contemplative action. So the first thing we have to do when we start talking about discernment is we have to remove ourselves from linear thinking. Discernment is not one-dimensional or two-dimensional. Discernment is three-dimensional. What I mean by that is discernment and action often happen simultaneously. They're in movement and partnership together. And so for whatever reason, many people have kind of pigeonholed discernment as this process that leads us to action, and it does. But what we've often done is said, well, while we're in discernment, we're not acting. And I'm like, whoa, 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 that's nonsense. Wait a minute. Discernment is our active ability to listen and to notice what God is up to in our midst. The word in Latin literally means to sift and sort, to become aware of God. So we're sifting through the noise and distraction of our world to notice God's invitation in the midst of all this chaos and brokenness. So we have to stop thinking linearly, and we have to start embodying this idea that Jesus gives us in Luke 5, which is, you know, they're out on the boat, they've been fishing all night long, and Jesus shows up, this carpenter who is not a fisherman, shows up on the boat and says, hey, you guys are fishing wrong. And you have to imagine the disciples were probably really angry by this. Like, wait a minute, man, you work with wood, we work with fish, we know how to fish, you don't. It's been a long night, we haven't caught anything, you need to relax before we get angry. And Jesus says, no, trust me, cast out into the deep. And you have to imagine these disciples are just like, oh my gosh, somebody get them off my boat before I toss them in the water. But yet somehow patience prevails and they say, okay, Jesus, we'll give this a go, but we're here to tell you we've been fishing all night. It ain't going to work. The fish are in the shallow water. And yet we know the story, right? They go deeper. They go deeper. They get off the surface, off the linear plane of thought, and they go deep. And they catch so many fish, the net breaks. They can hardly pull all the fish in. We need to embody that wisdom and go deeper into our discernment. So what I mean by that is contemplation and action, discernment and kingdom building happen simultaneously. They're in tandem together. And that grows because the more you act, the more inquiry you have, the more question you have, the more experience and invitation you have. And the more of those things you have, then the more you have to bring before God to say, God, where are you at in the midst of this? What's your invitation to us? Where are you at work in the midst of these things? And so anytime we separate action and contemplation or action and discernment, we need to be cautious because the two go in tandem with one another. But that gets us into three-dimensional thinking. And away from that, we often use discernment as a means to an end. And while it can be that and probably should be that, I often think we're missing the point because we'll hold ourselves captive to contemplation, waiting for this like magical okay moment to go and act based on what we've discerned, when in reality, hearkening back to the words of Mother Teresa, as we're discerning, we're engaging in small, meaningful actions.
It's kind of like partnering, if I can take back the idea of partnering with God.
Yeah.
Seems like we wait for God to tell us what to do, or do we actually work with God as God is acting in the world and through us and with us, but also with others whom we don't yet know?
Yeah. So you're answering your own question. The interesting thing here is that we cannot be advocates of peace and justice with God unless we are in relationship with God. And this is really hard for us because I don't know about our listeners, but I'm a control freak and I often don't have time for God. So I end up following my own agenda, my own desire, my own focus. The whole point of discernment is to hold us tightly in relationship with God. And so to authentically engage in the work of peace, in the work of justice, there's an assumption that I am already deeply in relationship with God, where I'm taking things to God, holding them with God, as God invites me into what God is already up to in our midst. And when you think about the movements of our church, of the community of Christ, most of these movements have happened because of encounter, because testimony, because someone has had such a transformational experience with God, they begin to act. That's discernment.
So I'm, you know, as we said, we were going to talk about ecumenical and interfaith partnerships. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of building up to all of this, because I think that part of the question that stands with me now is, okay, so in order to kind of work with others of other faiths or of other denominations in Christianity, we need to know first where and how we want to work and how we are going to partner with God and what is the preferred future that God has for us, but also for all the people that we share this planet with. Mm-hmm. Could you say something like, when did you work with others outside of our own faith community and that made a difference that otherwise would have gone unanswered? You know, I mean, it's like, if you hadn't done this with somebody else outside of our faith community, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I can share about the very first thing I ever did that put me on this path toward wanting to work in ecumenical and interfaith partnerships. So again, this was this is a story from my early 20s. I was at Graceland University in Lamoni, Iowa. I was a bit of a rebel radical then. And one of the issues in Decatur County, Iowa, in the United States, Decatur County at that time, and I don't know if it still is, was the poorest county in Iowa. And there were issues of food scarcity and families having the ability to access quality food and have groceries for their family to eat. And so with work with an incredible lady named Gwen Simpson, Community of Christ member in Lamoni, Iowa, and the local Methodist church, we began the process of creating a food bank, because the people who were affected by this issue of food scarcity weren't just Community of Christ. They were Methodists, they were Baptists, they were Catholic, they were Lutheran. And so we began the work of partnering and saying, look, this is an issue for our folks and it's an issue for your folks. It's an issue for the whole county. What can we do to make sure folks have access to food even when they don't have money, even if they don't have the financial capacity to go to the grocery store that, you know, had some programs for people of a lower economic status? And a long story short, we partnered with the Methodist Church in particular, but the other denominations in the area were also supportive and engaging. It was mostly the Methodist Church and the Community of Christ Church. But we worked together, and what ended up happening was Community of Christ had some financial capacity. The Methodist Church had some physical capacity, like building space. And so what we ended up doing was with Community of Christ financial resources and the Methodist building, we were able to, in their building, create, buy shelves, get food, create a partnership with other statewide nonprofits that provided food. And we were able to create this food pantry where through our church communities, get the word out to say, hey, if you can't afford groceries, if you're on hard times, if you're struggling finding quality food because of money reasons or any other reason, come here. We'll get you the food that you need. And we couldn't do that on our own. Community of Christ couldn't do that on our own. We didn't have a place for a food pantry, and we didn't necessarily have the volunteer capacity for it. But partnering with the Methodist Church, we had capacity for Community of Christ and Methodist volunteers. We had a physical location we could do. We had financial resources. And so pretty soon we had this complete picture where we could say, hey, no one in Decatur County needs to go hungry. We have a food pantry. We have a food bank where you can come. And we couldn't do it by ourselves. It required multiple faiths jumping in and saying, this impacts us. We believe in making sure that God's children are fed. We're going to do this together. And that was the very first ecumenical thing I ever did that put me on this path saying, wait a minute, we can't solve the issues of this world on our own. And indeed, we shouldn't try. But when we pool our resources and work together, we can make tangible difference in a meaningful way. So that was the first thing I did.
That sounds great. But how do you organize, you know, are there networks of food pantries out there, you know, that can do advocacy and advocate on the political issues that lead to people not having the sufficient food? You know, obviously those things exist, but is this something that we get involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is where we have to calibrate success and action to baby steps. So here's the thing. That was in 2000, I want to say 7. It's now 2020. That food pantry is still going strong. And the partnerships and advocacy that have come out of that, the Graceland Business Group, which is now called Enactus, has even engaged and participated in this food pantry. We've worked with senators and congress people from the state of Iowa who have come and told the story of what's happened in Lamoni and Decatur County as a success. And so when we start this work, it starts slow and it starts small. It's arduous, but it's meaningful and transformational. I didn't know the Methodist pastor when we began that work. I think Gwen knew her through just happenstance relationship, through community and relationship. And so this is where networking, the people that we know, become really important. And if you don't know them, make relationships with them. So when I was a young pastor, I was in my 20s in Southern California in the United States. I was a young pastor. I had no idea what I was doing. And we wanted to start engaging in some advocacy work. And so I called a local nonprofit called the Friendly Center in Southern California, got the name of some ministers who supported them. And this is no lie. I got the name of a guy named Stan, who was the pastor of a Disciples of Christ church, just a few miles away from our church. I called him and said, can we meet? Can we talk? And we just formed a relationship. I mean, there wasn't rocket science. It was just, I want to get engaged. I want to participate in relationship, and I want to change this community. I want to make sure no child goes hungry in Orange, California. I want to make sure that there are safe places for community in Orange, California. And through our relationship with Stan, we got involved with Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice. We got involved with California Power and Light, which is a climate change organization with clergy. We got engaged with a whole host of these networks of ecumenical and interfaith work, which ultimately led us to partnering on a panel for city government that moved us toward advocating for policy change based on the actions of faith and community. I can't speak for the European context, but the reality is in the United States that most food pantries, homeless shelters, access to school supplies and resources, even nonprofits, are religiously based in the United States. In Orange at the time, it was 80% of those things came out of churches or religious movements. And so we were able to go to the government and say, hey, we are the caretakers of this community and we have the data to back that up. And we need you to start making change and policy change implementation that reflects that for us. Because not only are we doing this together out of a sense of being missionally aligned and wanting to care for our neighbor as a theological mandate, we're a large voting block. And we're the people that vote in this community as well. I share all that to say these are small actions that build on one another over time because our network of relationship expands and our ability to participate with others grows. But it starts with, hey, I just met this family and they don't have access to food. I know this lady named Gwen. She cares a lot about this. I'm going to talk to her about it. We talk to her. Hey, I know the Methodist pastor. She has also mentioned this to me. Let's get together and see what we can do. Why don't we, you know, kind of survey our members and see if we can get some food together. And there's this nonprofit called Harvesters in Iowa. Maybe they'll give us some food and we can. And then 12 years later, it's still going strong. And, you know, I'm feeding hundreds of people. It's pushed me into relationships with pastors and priests and clergy from all over. I've sat on government councils. I've lobbied Congress people and senators in the United States. I've gone to the United Nations, all of these things because of just one little story of, hey, this family can't eat. What are we going to do about that? these small proximate purposes, building the bridge as we walk on it, this is where an action team starts. And it can happen anywhere. It can happen in Brussels, Germany, the UK, anywhere. What's happening in your neighborhood? And expand those relationships, expand that possibility.
I mean, this is a great change story that kind of probably informs your theory of change, how things actually can change. And I just want to make the link between where we started off, which was these transformational encounters with other people. And since I've been a student, I've been fascinated by this exploration of who the other is. So trying to learn from the other, the good that they embody. Could you mention a time where your own prejudice was challenged in relation to people of another faith? Yeah. I know that's kind of a bit like...
Just one time? Because there's been a lot.
No, but, you know?
Yeah. Gosh. This has taken me a long time, and I'm still learning. I'm learning how to not be right, and I'm learning how to not be in control. And I think I'm getting better at it, but I still have a lot of work to do. The best example I can give would be at an event called Ecumenical Advocacy Days in the United States. It happens in Washington, D.C. every year. And thousands of people from all kinds of Christian faiths, Christian denominations gather to worship together, to learn together. And then ultimately we go and lobby our representatives from where we live to say, hey, these are the things we want you to do for peace and justice in our country. And it's really amazing. Well, I'll never forget one year I was with, we were dealing with the issue of incarceration reform here in the United States, which if any of the listeners are familiar with the justice system in the United States, you know that our African Americans, Black people are incarcerated at outrageous numbers in comparison to white people in the United States. And so we need justice reform. We need reform on this front. And so I was going to lobby one day, and everyone I was lobbying with was of different faith than me, and they were different colors than me, right? It was Black people. And I was making some assumptions about why certain things were happening that they really helped me open my eyes to my privilege. The place in which I sat shaped what I saw. And so for me, I wasn't seeing issues of injustice. I was seeing, you know, I was treating it as this abstract system, and I was being helped to see the humanness of it. I had set aside the humanity of the issue to just make it a justice issue. And as we were advocating together, it became a human issue. These were brothers and sisters, sons, daughters, husbands, wives of people that were being treated without any reverence for their own belovedness. And so that's probably the best example, although it happens all the time. It happens so much that I have shifted my... There's an expectation, I think, sometimes because I run the seminary and I have a degree that I somehow know answers. And let me just clarify on this podcast, that is not true. I don't have the answers. I have no idea. In fact, if all of my education has taught me anything, it's taught me to constantly be in a stance of inquiry, to constantly hold ambiguity at the forefront, to know that I am a learner first. I'm a student. And anytime I go into a situation with the assumption of really knowing something, I need to be really cautious, because I learned really quickly that I was either making an assumption or I was off base or, you know, whatever it was. So I'm learning all the time about my prejudices, my privileges, the places in which I have blinders on to the world.
So if you're learning, imagine how some of us might feel about, you know, being in a learning position, especially when we go out into the world as lay ministers and try to, you know, just make a difference and have encounters that could lead to change. I mean, the reason I'm going there is because you mentioned also that we were pretty late to the game of ecumenical relations and interfaith work as a community of faith. also partially because we came to existence pretty late in 1860, yeah. 1830 to 1860. And I was just thinking how to reinvent the wheel. I mean, it's like, are we reinventing the wheel when we start saying, you know, go out there and do something good? Or is it really just about going out there and learning what other people are doing and joining in the work that they're doing?
Yes, it's a both and. To challenge the status quo, new things will have to be created. So on one hand, yeah, we're going to have to recreate something. On the other hand, that only happens through partnership and relationship with what other people are already doing. The hundreds of hours of work that have gone into advocacy and justice work ahead of us. And so I'm a big believer in inquiry. I'm a big believer in ambiguity. And here's why. All the great things that have changed the world happened because somebody asked a question. Somebody wondered and had curiosity. Somebody was so engaged in mystery that they discovered something new that changed the world, right? And we could go down the list of all the inventions and technological advances, but those things only happen because the discoverer had a willingness to not know. What's possible? How could this happen? I feel like there might be a way to do this thing. And so when we talk about justice and advocacy work, we have to know a couple things. One, you're going to change. You're going to go into this work or into a small action of creating a food pantry, and you're going to come out on the other end of it building a homeless shelter or walking the halls of parliament or whatever it is, right? Like you're going to discover new things, not only about yourself, but about your community, because you're going to hear more stories. You're going to see more things. You're going to be exposed to possibilities that previously you just didn't see because you weren't in that place. And so when we partner with other people, it begins with a simple inquiry. What is God up to? And what is God inviting me to? And then as we go out and we, you know, call random pastors or clergy on the phone, or we call up a local nonprofit or whatever it is that we do to engage in some small action, we continue that process of wonder and mystery, curiosity, as we partner. And through our willingness to not know, we discover something new. This is what it means to be a prophetic people. You cannot be a prophet and already know. To be a prophet by its very nature is to have a stance of inquiry with God. God, where shall you have me go? God, what are you up to? God, where are you calling me? Moses did this. Isaiah did this. Elijah did this. Jesus did this. I mean,
it leads to a lot of conflict.
It does. It does.
It's very uncomfortable, doesn't it?
It's very uncomfortable. And think about it. Moses was wanted for murder. And God shows up and says, hey, I need you to go back to the place where you're wanted for murder. Not only that, I want you to upset that empire even more. And I want you to take all their slaves and I want you to run away. And Moses has to be like, no way, I'm out. I just saw this really cool burning bush, but it was a mistake. I'm going to go back to the sheep, you know, right? And Jesus knows this. Jesus knows this so much to his core. And this gets back, El Rey, to our conversation about contemplation and action, the two happening simultaneously. Jesus always retreats in prayer. Jesus always finds time for solitude and contemplation, and then goes back into action. And so if we're really going to be prophetic, if we're really going to engage in peace and justice, Jesus gives us this model: action, retreat into prayer, back into action, retreat into prayer, all the while being in relationship with God. And so, yeah, it's uncomfortable. Yeah, it messes everything up. It's terrible. And it is perhaps the most rewarding incarnational experience of our faith.
So there's two kind of conflicting thoughts here for me. One is, you say everything is political, for example, in the United States. You mentioned that. Yep. And then the other is that I've heard you always say everything is theological.
That's right.
And bad theology leads to bad actions. I don't know.
Yeah. And bad politics. Yeah.
Bad politics, right?
Yeah.
So for me, it's kind of like, what I'm hearing in a way is that theology is below, I mean, is kind of foundational and also informs their political actions and policies. And I'm just wondering, who should we then ally ourselves with? How do we know which ministers to call?
You often won't. You often won't until you do. No, let me explain. So everything is theological, which means politics are theological. And I often tell people, you know, people will often say politics needs to stay out of church. You know, it's not, it gets too uncomfortable and disruptive and blah, blah, blah. And I often will agree with them. I'll say, absolutely. The problem is that politics have taken on theological issues. Immigration is not a political issue. It's in the Bible. That's a Bible first issue. So I have a prerogative to engage with that because Jesus talks to me about it, right? So our politics are theological, and our politicians have taken theological spiritual ideas and politicized them. So my job is not to be left or right, Democrat or Republican. My job is to incarnate Jesus. And that's where the real difficult work of theology comes into place, because if we don't have the proper theological education necessary, we begin to put our own interpretation on theology to support our agenda. And this has been done for thousands of years, right? This is why we've created theologies of racism, theologies of sexism, so on and so forth, which is why we have to do the theological work to say, what's the context here? Which directly connects us to the second part of your question, which is, how do we know who to act with? It's always contextual. It's always contextual. So partnerships in Germany may look very different than partnerships in France or the UK by virtue of the context of those cultures and what the needs of the community, issues of the community are that are facing. And so for me, our relationships often start with just a quick bit of research. Whatever issue it is that you're passionate about, find an organization that's already kind of working on that, and then go through their list of members or affiliates. See who's already partnering with them and what they're doing. And then this is the part that makes most people super uncomfortable. You got to show up in relationship. You got to pick up the phone and call somebody, or you got to just go and show up. And you'll feel really insecure about it because you won't know all the ins and outs of an issue. You won't know all the ins and outs of an organization. And you'll show up feeling really insecure, like, what am I doing here? I don't know what I'm doing. At the end of the day, this all comes from a sense of call. And this is really inappropriate for me as a theologian to do, but I promise Moses felt the same way. I promise Jesus felt the same way. Who am I to show up here and do this thing? What in the world am I doing? I am just some person. But yet, this is where our faith really shines, our relationship with God, to really lean on that sense of call. And that's why discernment is so important. That sense of call, that sense of being propelled out of our space into the movement of peace, having no clue what we're doing. But we show up and we learn. And we don't have the expectation that we know what we're doing. We simply have the expectation that God has asked me to be here, and I'm here. And I'm probably going to mess up, but I'm going to try really hard. And I mean, that's like the best advice I can give. And I know it sounds just totally inadequate, but that's what it is. It's our burning bush. It's our burning bush of, you want me to do what?
And hopefully, but I don't. Yeah, sorry, I'm cutting you off. But then I'm like, and hopefully somebody is there to tell the tale afterwards, right?
That's absolutely right.
The story propagates, and this idea of hope can be established. So thank you, Zach, so much for being part of this follow-up podcast to the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. You've given us some of your time, some of your important reflections. You're helping us discern, helping us give us some ideas about the simple steps we can take to start making a difference in the world, in our communities, in our neighborhoods, and just as people of faith. I do have a last question.
Sure.
I'm just like, how do we work with people of no faith?
So even atheists are making a theological statement, right? So, but people of no faith still have morals, ethics, and values. They still have something that has shaped their principle of community, of society, of civility. And so we always have to be really keenly thoughtful about ecumenical and interfaith work, knowing that this isn't the work of convincing people to think like you think or believe what you believe or become part of your church. This is the work of incarnation. So we're not getting into battles of beliefs. We are really, really becoming ambassadors of Matthew 25. And Matthew 25 is where Jesus shows up and he's like, hey, where were you all at when I was hungry and thirsty and all these other things? And the disciples are like, what are you talking about? We've been believing all these things. And we've been, you know, off here doing the belief thing. And he's like, the Gentiles, the non-believers, the people of no faith, they incarnated what I taught you. They gave me water. They gave me shelter. They gave me clothing. And so Jesus points this out, right? Like Jesus makes a real pivotal statement to these disciples. You must embody, you must incarnate this idea. This is not an intellectual exercise to be left in the halls of sanctuaries and cathedrals. This is a movement of incarnation to heal and transform a broken world. And so people's individual, now there may be relational moments on the outskirts of this work to have those conversations and engage in that. And indeed that should happen, but we're missionally aligning ourselves to address hunger, poverty, human migration, climate change, whatever it is. And I can really only speak from a Community of Christ context because that's who I am. My faith calls me to embody that Matthew 25 idea. I'm not here to proselytize. I'm not here to baptize. I'm not here to convince that my faith is better than yours. I am here to clothe the hungry, to give drink to the thirsty, to give shelter to the shivering cold. That's my prerogative in this movement. All the other stuff that happens at other moments in my life as a disciple, but this work that we're doing, it's focused, it's clear, and it's about embodiment and incarnation.
Thank you, Zach, for again testifying to the importance of transformational encounters and meeting the other. But not only that, but it seems like, you know, being conscious about who the other is and what the other's needs are, doing the work more than actually saying it or singing it, or, you know, amen. One way to end on this would be to, that we, from Doctrine and Covenants, I think it's 165 now, that says, do not only sing and speak of Zion, but live, love, and share as Zion.
Oh, don't leave out the best part, El Rey.
Okay. Which is
the follow-up of live, love, and share as Zion, those who strive to be visibly one in Christ, among whom there are no poor or oppressed.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Zach, for being part of this follow-up podcast to the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. Thank you for your time and your important reflections and helping us identify those simple steps for us to start making a difference in the world. And thank you to all of our listeners. Join us next to listen to Ryan and Georgia Comins share their answers to the question, can peace begin on our plates, nonviolence, and what we eat, as we all continue to explore together our many different grounds for peace.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.